j'ai plumé la tête de mon alouette.
J'ai plumé la tête de mon alouette.
J'ai plumé la tête de la queue.
Hello and welcome to Nerd Kitchen. This is Max, and with me today I have a very special guest, returning guest rather. Welcome to the show, Anu.
Hey, hi.
We had a lot of fun. Yeah, we had a lot of fun talking about with you last time when we were talking on the pasta episode.
Yeah.
And you know, since then I make pasta at least once a month now. So welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It was awesome that I listen to you guys very often, and especially your guests you get, and you know, it's like really fun to listen to.
Well,
so
thank
yeah,
you.
I'm very glad to be back.
So today's episode, we wanted to talk about forgotten foods. There's a lot of foods or recipes which were integral to, you know, integral to our palates, maybe let's say 50, 60 years ago, but then over a period of time and with people moving away from villages into cities and, you know, with supermarkets and all of this coming in, a lot of these foods have kind of been disappearing from the kitchen table to almost today. It's a point where they're endangered in a way. And the only time you ever hear them is in like a fancy upmarket restaurant where, you know, like a chef will bring them back to as like a star dish and everyone will go really wow about it. But then as you take a step back, like, yeah, you know, this is something like my grandmom used to make. And it's almost like things that were commonly used, almost like peasant food, if you can use the word, are no longer in fashion, but are brought to fashion only for, you know, making them like these as some exotic ingredient or something. So we wanted to talk about some of these foods and the reasons behind them, why we would use them, and maybe even go into a couple of recipes if time permits. So Anu, why don't you start us off by telling us your memories from eating at your grandma's place or something like growing up?
Yeah, definitely. So my maternal grandmother, she's from Bangalore, so proper Kannada family, and she married into a Tamil family. So my grandfather and his entire family from Tamil Nadu, and she moved here. When she moved here, she got like her own recipes from Bangalore. So I grew up eating her food, which was like a proper, I would say like a mixture of both Kannada and Tamil recipes. On my father's side, everybody was from Tamil Nadu itself. So all the recipes in my paternal grandma's house were all very, very Tamil Brahmin kind of recipes. So I grew up eating I would say a variety of food. And my mom, obviously, that's who I learned most of my cooking from, was clearly influenced by her mom. So all my recipes are more have like a both Kannada and Tamil mix to it. Like everybody has their, like every family I know has their own kootu recipe or their own sambar powder recipe. So the recipes that I use are heavily influenced by these. So and speaking of memories, I would spend 2-3 months of my summer holidays every year in my party's house, as was very common that day. My mom would we'll take the train, we'll go there, she'll drop us off, say bye bye, and then we'll spend months there with the cousins playing around and you know, eating all the time. And so mostly what I remember is my grandma's house had these guava trees and coconut trees. So we ended up drinking coconut water every day, like, and eating raw guavas out of, plucking them straight out of the trees. And my party will be in the kitchen cooking like the whole day, I would say, like making snacks for us, making dinner for us, and all the cousins will sit around her, and she'll like give us like a little bit of Kurumbasadam topped with a little whatever curry was there, mostly podalanga, I think, because she had a plant growing in the backyard. So these are the kind of things I immediately associate with food, which is, I would say, mostly got to do with family and relationships for me, like whenever I think about it. And I just feel like all these memories that I have, my cousins, like my children don't see their cousins like for more than, now they haven't seen them in many years, but it's usually just like once a year or so. And I feel like for them, food is, the memories they have of food is only of me cooking and nothing else. So yeah, it's a different kind of times now and then.
You're 100% right. And like for me, my biggest memories are guava, mango, and jackfruit. Like, you know, climbing the mango tree and getting mangoes. Yeah. And jackfruit. Like, I pride myself now in telling that I can kind of slice a jackfruit and, you know, completely dissect it and do a proper clean dissection of either both a raw as well as a ripe jackfruit. And that only came because of that. It's almost a lost art, if I may.
Definitely. Like, I can't do it. I never grew up, like, we were all from north of Tamil Nadu, and jackfruit was not very common. It's something that you found in the store. It's something I never got to do, and I don't think I can do it.
Yeah, it's almost like an operation. You know, kind of get your hands greased in coconut oil and then you dive into it and, you know, you go in a certain order so that, you know, you don't create too much mess and all that. But the other thing, like, and as you mentioned, it's a lot of it is soul food, right? A lot of it is soul food. It reminds you of those memories. And so recently I was on Clubhouse in a room where they were discussing, is Asian food healthy? And mm-hmm. I almost started laughing midway through the conversation, because for this very reason, because I was thinking that if you kind of travel back in time, like 30, 40 years ago, like the food that, you know, we grew up as kids eating, or our parents ate, was mostly, you know, stuff that was just boiled or quickly heated, like a poriel or something, or things that were, you know, steamed. There was slow cooking and so on. So they were automatically healthy by definition, not only for the ingredients they used, which we'll get to in a bit, but also just the different cooking techniques that were applied around that time.
Yeah.
They were naturally healthy. And so that's what I was kind of talking about it.
Yeah, and like any dessert or anything like that was always like a special occasion food for us. It was never, you never had dessert with every meal. Or even like the snacks and all, it was never bought from the store. It was something made at home, and that was always made occasionally for us. So yeah, most of the food that we ate was like fermented, home cooked, vegetable heavy food. That's what I remember. My mom always made 2-3 vegetables with every meal. So
and even the vegetables, right? So today, if you step into any grocery store, the vegetable section, you could count off maybe like 20 to 25 vegetables that they have, and they are the same across continents. Almost. I mean, there'll be a few, you know, like which are local and will show up here and there. But otherwise, most of the ones that you all get, the commonly used ones, are pretty much the same. And because of the way, you know, farming techniques and so on, they also kind of taste the same throughout the year or anywhere you go. But
yeah.
And that's what I was saying in my opening statement, is that when we were eating or our grandmoms were cooking, they used a lot of vegetables or grains, which A, were locally sourced, and B, they were not just using them because it was locally available, saying, oh, you know, there's something growing in my backyard, let me just use it. Maybe there were a few like that as well, and probably that's how it started. But they all, at least the ones, most of them I remember, all had some sort of a medicinal quality to it, right? You ate something because it helped in somewhere else, or at least as kids, that's what we were told. If you eat this, you know, this will happen. And
definitely. Like I still remember my party was very religious. So she would fast every month for Ekadasi. The whole day, they won't eat anything. And then the next day, like to break the fast, like for Dwadasi, they will make this kirai, which is which I think was made only then, which was like they say was super healthy because it like totally cleanses your body. Now everybody does intermittent fasting and, you know, like I don't know what it's called, 5-3-3-2 or something like that. But yep, you know, this was nothing new because it was like a way of life. Exactly. For us, it was nothing that we had to go out of our way to do it. It was just how it was. And
you're right. You had these, again, India at least was abundant in greens. And in Tamil Nadu, everything is a kirai, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
If you go to the Andhra, everything is a kura. You know, they're all called kuras or kirais. But despite an abundance of different types of greens, they had very specific reasons for particular greens. Like I said, some greens were acting as detox agents. So after fast or something, you would have that and would kind of like a diluteric, you know, flush out your entire body. There were some greens that were used more, let's say, for women just after childbirth because it would kind of help with lactation, things like that. There's some greens that were used because they're analgesics or would help in digestion. Laxatives. So
there was this kirai called running. I think Modakatan kirai. I truly don't know its English name. I can like Google it now, but that my mom used to make because my party, when she was getting older, she had like her knee problem, like her knees would crack, and this kirai was supposed to be very good for it, like your bones. So she used to make it like once a week. It'll be like kirai. Sometimes it'll be grind into dosai. So I don't even know the name and I've never had it in years now, but I was thinking about it, like, you know, kirai as medicine, definitely that comes to mind.
Yeah. And again, it's not, and when you say medicine, right, there's a connotation to it that it's not tasteful, or, you know, they are sour, or you don't have a good memory when someone says the word medicine. But the, a lot of these, vegetables or greens, they would taste fabulous. So you would not know almost what you're eating actually is something unless someone told you after the meal. And so despite, you know, having medicinal properties and all, and maybe like if you eat it raw, yes, you know, some things would be taste bitter or
but it was cooked perfectly. So
exactly, they're cooked perfectly, I think is the most operative word, because they were not overcooked. A lot of them were like just steamed, or, you know, like a quick saute, steamed in like a quick saute or something like that. But then, so they retained a lot of their medicinal properties as well as structural integrity, but then at the same time ended up being tasty and so on. So one of the things I wanted to start off with in the series of forgotten foods is what in Tamil Nadu is called the pirandai. Now, that is a very interesting kind of a vegetable, because it is classified as a green, but the leaves are not what is eaten, right? It's known as, the English name is the adamant creeper. It's from the cissus family, right? But it's the stalk that is eaten. Also in the stalk, it's only the topmost, the tender most stalk.
Tender
because
part of it,
if you eat the bottom parts, you know, then your kind of throat starts itching, or even while dealing with it with your hands, your hands start itching. But it has its roots, it has its mentions all the way back to like Siddha medicine, because it would help, it would be used as an analgesic, it would help bones. And also, like, one of the names in Siddha medicine for that is Asthi Samharaka. So Asthi is bones, and because it will help to kind of join your bones, it has its mentions there. Mm-hmm. So Anu, do you recollect like a recipe that we can think about with pirandai? I think one I remember is like in a tamarind based gravy or so.
Yeah, but my mom, she always made like a tugayal out of it, which was like a chutney. Yep. But I wouldn't say chutney because for me, chutney is a different kind and tugayal is a different kind because tugayal is always made with lentils, like roast lentils, red chili, tamarind and coconut. And so these are the main base ingredients for a tugayal. And on top of that, you can add anything, literally anything that can be made into a tugayal if you have the base right. So a parupu tugayal will have only these four: lentils, red chilies, coconut, and a bit of tamarind. And you add more and more to it. And perendai was something my mom used to like prepare very carefully. Like it is almost has like a very interesting shape. So you have to like peel off the hard bits of it.
The and ridges use, that it has.
Ridges yep. of it, yeah, mm-hmm. like a ridge guard. So you have to peel the ridges of it and you cut it and you saute it along separately in a little bit of oil so that, you know, it's not like stringy anymore. And then you grind it with these lentils, red chilies, coconut, which are all roasted, of course, and a bit of tamarind. And she always made this during Amavasai time, because it was not like a, like my mom would call them nalla nal vegetables. There are certain things you made on like auspicious days and certain things that you made on like Amavasai or for Devasam or something like that. So perendai was always made during these days for me. And to be honest, like now it's just a fond memory, and I can, if I try to recollect the smell or the taste of it, I can hardly do it because I haven't eaten it in many years now, and I think it's not something, I don't know even now, because we always had like this creeper growing in a small pot in our house. I don't even know if you can buy it in the store in India anymore. I mean, I am not the authority now about what you can get in Indian markets, but I don't know. I haven't even seen my mom make it in a long time now. So,
yeah, and if you again, we had it growing in our house. But if you look at it, it's no beauty to look at either. It's almost no. like it's like some sort of a weed. You know, it's a very sturdy weed also.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's only when you do, then you later realize that actually this is. It tastes good. Like my memories are in eating it as a koyamba with tamarind and so on. And because it's only the tender portions are used, it kind of almost melts in your mouth. So
definitely,
it is very tasty. But then later as you grow up, you realize, oh, it probably had all these other qualities as well.
Yeah, so, you never realize like that some of these things that you used to eat are medicinal in any way at all. You just eat it because, you know, your mom makes it and it tastes good.
Exactly. So next on the list is the Manathakali, or commonly in English known as the black nightshade. Now, the black nightshade, again, there are different nightshades, but this one particular nightshade from the Solanum family grew a lot almost everywhere. Like, again, it was like almost like a wild shrub that would grow, and you had these berries that would sprout up. Now, the unripe berries, if you try eating them, they are not fun.
No.
They almost cause like irritation in the mouth. They have like a mild toxin, but once they are ripe, they almost, you know, they turn reddish orange. And the name also is indicative of that, because takali is tomato. And so manathakali means fragrant tomato.
Yeah.
So they have a lot more flavor, but then they're again berries. They're really, really small, but they have, again, a lot of medicinal properties. And one my mom used to say a lot is, you know, they are antioxidants. And then they also help in either stimulating the appetite or even as a laxative. So it has many medicinal uses. And again, I remember the leaf, which is known as the Manathakali Kire, is used in porials. And the berries, are also, okay, not the So the ripe berries we've eaten as just as is because
yeah, I used to like pluck it straight off like the you know garden and just like it's so fun to play eat because it's like it almost bursts in your mouth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then also, you know, they make them, they use them for coim. So, yeah, why? Yeah, actually, you're the better authority here. So, why don't you start us off on what can we do with the manathakali?
Manathakali, the kirai, of course, you can cook it like any kirai. But again, manathakali kirai, I haven't had it in such a long time, but I love it. It's got such a unique taste. And my mom used to make a kootu with it, sometimes more kootu, like, kootu itself, you know, like we categorize into three, like poricha kootu, which doesn't have any souring agents to it, or pulipu kootu, which has a souring agent to it, like either tamarind or sour curd. So the more kootu is something I really, really like very much. And of course, the berries themselves, while it's like fun to pick and eat or like simply burst in your hands, it got such gorgeous, like almost like a deep purple color. Mm-hmm. So so it's fun to play with, but more in a cuisine, it's more used when it's dried up as a vattal. So this also this preservation is a great thing of our cuisine, like all over India, like because, you know, in the past, because there was no refrigeration, it was not grown year around. So if you want to eat it some other time of the year, you have to preserve it. So this vattal or just to dry, sun dry it kind of thing was used very, very commonly. So manathakali also is very commonly available even now as a vattal. Mm-hmm. So it's dried up and you can get it anywhere. Like even here in supermarkets, you can I wouldn't say supermarkets, in Indian stores, like wherever I've been, we find it very easily. So this vattal, yeah, we make it into korambu very often. So vatta korambu itself is a very common name now. So any vattal, you can make it into a gravy with tamarind and spice. So it's super tasty. But my mom used to make this vattal. She would just fry it up in ghee, like until it is like super fragrant, just fry it. And then she would just serve it on top of like hot rice with a bit of salt. And you just passengerify it with, you just mix it into the rice with your fingers. So it just crumbles into the rice because it's been fried so much. And she used to give this whenever we had like a bad tummy or a tummy upset. And it's supposed to like totally cleanse your system and make you feel better. So this, and of course, the Thair Sadam were the only things you were given when you had like a tummy upset. This, and of course, even Sundakai, she used to do the same thing. So whichever vattal was easily available. Sundakai is the turkey berry. So that is also dried up. So Sundaka vattal or Manathakali vattal, whichever was available, used to be roasted and given for like tummy aches. So these are the recipes that I remember most of Manathakali.
Oh no! I mean, when you were describing the manathakali vettel, you know, fried in ghee and then crumbling.
Yeah, you want rice, to eat it right now, right?
I was. Yeah,
I'm definitely going to have it tomorrow morning. Yeah.
Because yeah, I also think I have a packet of lying around, but
yeah,
it never struck me that you could do it this way. Again, yeah, we do the you know, we do it as a vattakorumbu kind
for
of a thing, but
yeah,
this is. Yeah, now, yeah, I'm going to have to try this. But no, it's nice you brought up the turkey berry as well, Sundaka, because similarly, you know, these are, a lot of these berries were abundant. Again, the berries are shrubs and, you know, it's not like you have to kind of plant them or take a lot of care and all that. And most of the time, they would just be berries growing outside the kitchen and, you know, they would just, you know, like once you cut up a tomato or cut up, you know, like a eggplant or something, or the tops or something, you just keep throwing onto it and it just, you know, keeps growing. But you have these berries which then are, you know, fun to use to eat, but then also have all these medicinal properties. It's kind of fabulous,
yeah, like
of how this comes together.
Here, for the first time, like when I went to the farmer's market, when I moved here to the Caribbean, I saw this turkey berry was selling in the farmer's market. and nobody was buying it. And the farmer who was growing it, he was Jamaican, and he said that they call it susumber. He says it was like, it's very good for treating diabetes, because they dry it and powder this and use it in their food and their curries and stuff like that. And I was super surprised to find this green turkey berry here in a farmer's market. You know, I never knew that it was used anywhere except India, but I was really surprised. I even have like a bag of it like sitting in my freezer right now, and I still I can use it whenever I, and again, it's only like, because in the farmer's market, it's not available throughout the year. Like maybe sometime in the winter it will come, and I always buy like a bag of it, just $2, because nobody buys it. And I just put it in the freezer and I can use it throughout the year. But yeah.
Wow. That's awesome. Yeah. I would have never thought that it would find its way into Jamaican cuisine and as well. I mean, I would expect if it was more, let's say, in Southeast Asia, maybe like places like Thailand, Vietnam, or something like that, because of, you know, the trade routes and all that. But it finding its way all the way into Jamaican cuisine is crazy. Didn't expect that. That was good to know today.
Yeah.
So
then they call it susumber, because I started laughing when he said that, and in their accent it sounded totally something different to me. He said that, you know, they use it, and he says even now nobody in Jamaica also knows about it, and it's something like only like, you know, it's become like an old world kind of recipe even in Jamaica. So
I mean, they have a strong iron content, so it's definitely, I can see the benefits of it, but yeah, it's, these are almost lost today.
Yeah.
The next one I wanted to mention was the Ponangani. Right? The Ponangani is from the Cecilis family, and it's commonly known. The English name is the Cecil Joy weed. Similar to the other one, like, you know, it's used as a kire, but also the stems are also used. But then it has cooling properties, dilutaric properties, and also for stomach ailments as a laxative as well. What recipes do you remember with the Ponangani, Anu?
Ponangani, the most I remember is my mom making a poriel out of it. So, like I said, anything poriel for us in our family is something with coconut. So, like when you say porichakootu, it is kootu with coconut. And when you say poriel, it is vegetable stir fry, which is then topped with coconut. So I always remember my mom making a poriel out of it, and that was my favorite, because the coconut always added, the Ponangani kire had a slight bit of bitterness to it, and so when you add a fresh grated coconut on it, it kind of balances out beautifully, and I really like that that combination. So that was my favorite recipe, where you just saute the Ponangani kire. The tadka is usually mustard and red chilies, and you saute this, and then you finish it off with some fresh grated coconut. That's my favorite recipe that my mom used to make. Of course, she made the regular like kirai masiyal out of it, but I never liked it that much. It was a little too bitter for me. I always enjoyed the poriel better.
So just like Anu earlier mentioned, togel, right, is this formulatic thing of how you bring in, of how you could use it across a whole gamut of vegetables. Similarly, poriel also follows that. It's this concept of where you have, mustard seeds, urad dal, onions, turmeric and red chilies and shredded coconut sometimes there is that the main vegetable, and the main vegetable is replaceable. You could do it with beans or eggplants or okra or whatever you want, and
the method is the same.
Yeah, the method is the same, and it's also healthy, because it's quick. It's a very quick recipe, right?
Like it's stir almost frying. Like a quick stir fry. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a stir fry with some oil, sometimes coconut oil, depending on where you are. Because if you are in Kerala, then it's called the Merikuparatti, or in Andhra, it's called a Vepudu. But conceptually, they're all the same. They may use different oils or have some things, but that whole concept of quick stir fry any vegetable, and if it's a harder vegetable, then the vegetable steamed before you do a stir fry.
Yeah.
But that quickly adds, gives a taste. And then because it's not on heat for too long, you know, the vegetable doesn't break down either. So it still maintains its structure. And like Anu said, you make it with any vegetable now.
Any vegetable, any like even the kirail, any greens, anything, you can make it into a quick puriel. And if you, you know, make like some rasam with it, and then you are done with lunch or dinner, because, you know, is nothing unhealthy there. And it's like really takes half an hour in the kitchen and you're done.
So we spoke about some greens. We spoke about these berries. Let's then go to grains. And it's almost sad that if you like stopped someone today and asked them, can you name 10 grains? They'll probably stop after 4 or 5. And especially from India, where we have an abundance of grains, all, you know, throughout the entire geography, not just certain pockets, but everywhere, there are so many grains that are there. People just, you know, have forgotten them. Now, for again, because it's the in thing, everyone suddenly knows quinoa, where, yeah, you know, and we're importing it, you know, all over the world. But then there are so many other grains that are readily available and have been part of, you know, have
our
been
diet.
Part of our diet, but we have just disappeared. One of those is kollu or horse gram. And it gets its name because, yes, it was often used in the feed for horses, but also has its, but it has its mentions in Ayurveda and all that as well for human consumption. Yeah. So what can you tell us about kollu or horse gram, Anu?
Kollu was very, my mom always had like a dabba, like one of these old stainless steel dabbas, which is what she used to put all her grains and pulses in. They all were like these round dabbas, which I would absolutely love to have now rather than the plastic dabbas. But she always had this kollu at home. And like kollu rasam is the most popular that, you know, everybody does these days. And, you know, if you search for kollu recipes on Google, mostly that will come up is a kollu rasam. But my mom used to use kollu in almost like a sundal, which sundal was always made once a week in my house. Like, so it'll always replace one of the puriels that we do, one of the stir fry sides that we have for rice. So kollu sundal was made once a month. And I really liked the sundal, because my mom used to put a nice spicy powder on it, and that tasted amazing. And later she also started to make a kollu podi, like it was like a parupu podi or something like that, but you replace kollu instead of the lentil, and you mix it with rice and eat. So both, so this podi also is such a godsend for, my mom was a working woman. So she's like, she has to finish everything in the morning before 9 o'clock. So, and when she comes back in the evening at 6 and dinner has to be ready, podis were always like our lifesavers for us. That was always available. And you know, they don't need to be refrigerated, but was always available. And you just make rice and some podi is there. So you're done. So kollu podi also my mom used to make very often. And I'm really ashamed I don't make it that often these days. But yeah, that is, I still remember that. This is bringing back a lot of memories for me, because, you know, some of these things you don't, in your busy life, you don't sit and think about these things.
So kollu in Andhra or Telangana, the horse gram, you know, is known as ulavalu. And it was prescribed for, you know, jaundice or something that, you know, because it has diuretic properties. So as part of, or weight loss as well. And one of the most famous preparations in that part of the region is called ulava charu. Charu again, you know, or saru in Kannada is like a cousin of the rasam, because it's correct. This soupy dish. But one of the brilliant combinations, which is from just that region, is called ulava charu biryani.
Ooh.
So it's biryani, but then...
I'm writing it.
Yeah, and so, you know, you have the ulava charu or the sauce gram soup that is kind of poured over it. And that's... So instead of like a salan or something, you're having it with the ulava charu. There is actually one restaurant close to my house who now makes Ulva Chaur biryani. So that's one of the things I order pretty often from them.
It's amazing.
But you can think about it, like how, you know, like everyone likes to eat biryani and things like that. But then you're pairing it with Ulva Chaur, which again is very filling because horse gram, you know, is very, very filling, which is why they would offer it to horses because, you know, it, the amount of protein that you get out of it is insane. But that's one of my biggest memories of you know, horse cram. And like my granddad also, you know, would kind of when he would live with us, then my mom would make that as well. It was not more as a rasam, but also almost like a like an avial or a poriel with horse cram.
Nice.
And then we'll come to millets. And this is what gets my goat, is that with an abundance of millets, we're all just looking elsewhere to saying, what are the healthy alternatives that we can use in our diet or how we can, you know, reduce
our rice
consumption or things like that. And so there's three or four millets that come to my mind. Like, so ragi, I think everyone kind of knows it's a lot more common than some of the other ones. But the varaga or kodo millet, samai, which is the proso millet, or tine, which is the foxtail millet, are very almost endangered or extinct these days. So what are your memories with these, Anu?
So millets, my mom used to cook very often. And even my party, like once a week or so, instead of rice, we will have it. And of course, whenever my mom made pongal, sometimes she just used to sneak in the millets. Like, you know, my dad was like, yeah, arisi panla, yeah, sadam panla. So he was not a big fan of the millets. And she used to sneak it into pongal, or like when she made arisi upma, instead of arisi upma, she used to replace with the millets and make it. So we never, like, I see a lot of recipes now because the millets are making a big comeback, at least in the foodie world. And so I see a lot of recipes for idli dosai, where you replace the rice with millets. But my mom never did that. Mostly it was pongal, which I used to love, and it will taste like really amazing. And especially the varagarisi, the kodo millet, pongal was like really good. And and the upma also, I still remember, because my mom's arisi upma was something else. She used to make in this big cast iron urli. And there used to be like a whole layer of the kandal at the bottom. So they like the thadig or whatever you call it. It was like, we used to fight for that pieces. So yeah, that's... those are the recipes that come to my mind like almost immediately when I think of millets.
I think foxtail millet and some of these millets are available even here, but then they are insanely priced because they're sold more as exotic.
And they come in like such small packets. Like you buy one packet of millet for here, it's like almost like $7-$8. You buy them and it's like almost people use it like as a... they cook it and use it like a sprinkling on the salads or something like that. So, you know, it's insanely expensive to buy for everyday use now.
Yeah. So you can't kind of, you know, use it like a rice substitute or something like that. Because,
no, it's but, just, as I said, you could use it like maybe once a month or something like that, but it is not cheap to use these things. And to think like this was a staple like in India and rice was something that came later. It's surprising how expensive these have become.
So let's talk about some of these preparations, because as we mentioned earlier, right, a lot of the dishes also are now kind of out of memory or for people. And like we were talking, a lot of the cuisine or these forgotten foods from our grandmom's time were involved fermentation, preservation, or just steaming. One of those that comes to my mind, again, as a concept, now it has many variations based on festivals and the ingredients, is the kali. two of the most famous ones that I remember, at least, are the Mor Kali or the Thiruvadhari Kali. But let's talk about Kali as a concept first before we go into some of these variations and recipes.
Yeah. So Kali is, I think, is more like a, I would say like a thickened porridge. I'm trying to find the right, the English word for it. But I think that is pretty much what it is, like a more thickened porridge kind of consistency is what I can think of. And so this Kali, we made in with so many different things, and like two particular recipes come to me. One, you already mentioned the Mor Kali. It was my grandfather's favorite thing ever. And my mom used to make it whenever my grandfather visited us. And that was his favorite tiffin of all times, the Mor Kali. And my mom used to temper it with more molagai instead of using the regular red chilies. So that's so like that had like a really amazing flavor to it. And I still today when my and I don't make Mor Kali that often because it's not, again, right now I'm catering to cooking for three kids. So you always, whenever you're starting to think for a meal, you're like, okay, I should make something that everybody will eat. That way, you know, I spend less time in the kitchen. So Mor Kali never comes up, but that is one of my favorite things to make. And the other one was the Ulitang Kali my mom used to make. So Ulitang Kali is made with the black whole urad dal, the one with the skin on. And my mom used to make this for me like every month when I started my period, because she says it's really good for your bones, and it has like a lot of iron content, so it's good for it. And she made this with the urad dal, which was you know, roasted slowly on, and then it was ground into powder, and then it was like mixed with jaggery, and it was like slowly made into like a porridge until it thickened. And she used to add like sesame oil, like gingerly oil on it, and she used to serve it to me. And I don't know, I truly never have made it in my life, that Ulitang Kali, and I would really love to learn to make it. That's like one of those recipes that I've never had the chance to make. But whenever somebody says Kali, Thiruvadhari Kali was never, we are Iyengar, so we never made Thiruvadhari Kali at home. But the Ulitang Kali is something that my mom used to make like every month, and I still really think about it, and it tasted amazing.
Yeah, and like I said, the Kali is very interesting as a concept, because it involves this rice-based batter, if you can call it, that is then slowly reduced and reduced till it almost becomes cakey, right? And
yeah,
but it takes time.
It's a slow process.
Yeah, it's a slow process. It takes time, and probably that's probably the reasons why it's no longer, you know, in fashion and so on. Like the Thiruvadhari Kali, at least because it has a religious connection with it, you know, it is made on the day of Thiruvadhari. I don't know the reasons why, but that probably still people make or is known, but like Mor Kali and all is not. And these two I kind of remember a lot, because they are, one is savory and the other one is sweet, but they're very similar in their preparation, right? So you have rice, and then mung dal, which then you kind of roast, you make it into a paste, and then once you get your jaggery melting, then you add this along with water, carbon powder, ghee, and so on, and then you slowly keep it cooking. It cooks, and then as it's done, the, you know, all it's reduced, all the water is evaporated, but then the rice is kind of cooked in that whole water, and so it's not it's almost cakey, which you can kind of all depending on how you do it, it's mostly just scooped up and put onto plates, but you can also kind of cut it off like a barfi if you wanted to get that consistency. Same thing goes with the morkali, because again, you know, the morkali is slightly different because there is fermentation involved, right? So yeah. You're soaking idli rice, and then you're draining that along with coconut water, and then once that is done, you're letting it kind of ferment for almost 24 hours or so. And after that is when you're then cooking it down in the tempering, and then slowly kind of also becomes into a cake. So you kind of can almost, like a dhokla, you can kind of cut it into cubes. I mean, it's not as foamy as a dhokla, but you know, if you wanted like a mental representation of it. But again, these recipes, if you think about it, because they have very less oil, they're mostly cooked on a low flame, so they're healthy, and the ingredients that go into it is like rice or yogurt or coconut or jaggery and things like that, which you know are naturally good.
And my party also used to make a curry with ragi flour. So, they call it, my party used to call it, okay, my Kannada is really awful, but my party used to call it mudde, and so it was like a round ball.
Ragi mudde.
Yes. So she made that. My mom never made it, but I think it's a very Kannadiga recipe, and she used to eat it with kootu, like just like a round ball of this kali would replace your rice, and you would just mix it with the kootu and eat it either for lunch or for tiffin. So she used to make that very often too. So that is another thing that came to my mind, but my mom never made it that much. No, my party used to make it.
Yeah, like any other forgotten recipes that you can think of, Anu?
I would say, like, even for example, if you take, I'm just speaking from my personal experience, everybody's might be different, but for me, like something as simple as upma, if you think, it's very easy for me to make like a rava upma with suji or a semya upma with vermicelli, because these are very easily available. Like I can literally even buy like roast suji or roast vermicelli, and all of it takes is just the time to boil water to make upma, and it's ready in like 15 minutes and the tiffin's done. But something like this arisi upma that I was talking about earlier, which my mom used to make with millets also sometimes, that is something like is not easily available. Like the base for it, arisi upma, is not available in the store. So you have to like wash the rice, dry it out on a like a dhoti, like it's not dry, sun dried, but it has to be dried indoors, and then you coarse grind it with a little bit of dal, and then this is the base for the arisi upma or the pidi kolukattai that we always had. My mom used to call this kappi, so we always had this upma kappi now in a dabba in our house. So my mom made arisi upma every Saturday night. Like that was our tiffin, because Saturdays she never used to have like onions or garlic. That was like a practice in our house. So she made arisi upma for dinner. And I haven't made arisi upma in, I cannot think when was the last time I made it. So because it takes a lot of time to cook, you know, it's not, when you think of upma, you think of fast food and say, okay, you don't have anything else. You make it in 15 minutes, upma is ready. But this arisi upma, like as I said, she used to make it in a cast iron pan. And like you have to stir it. And it takes like an hour or so to cook. And then later she discovered when the Prestige pressure pan came, she discovered she could do it. She doesn't have to do it in a cast iron pan. But I truly missed the cast iron pan when she got a pressure pan. But it takes a long time to cook because like arisi itself takes some extra time to cook, and that is something like I miss a lot, that you know, it's simply because it's a slow cooking process, and we do not have the time right now, and it's not it is not like a judgmental thing, but we simply, even I don't have the time. I have three kids, I have a full-time job, and like as much as I love cooking, I don't have that much time to cook every day. So it's this is like a lost recipe, and I don't think my kids have ever eaten arisi upma, you know. And if I make it, I don't know if they will like it or not. So it's just like a vicious circle. I don't know if I'll make it, but you know, whenever I make upma or whenever on a Saturday night I'm making dinner and I'm thinking of my mom, it always comes to my mind, but I don't do it. Or yeah, even the simple process of making vattal early summer every year, go to the motamadi and you know, it is like a whole day process where you make the vattal koor either with sago or with arisi, and then you go up, you make the vattal, and then you sit with the black tuni there, or you prop the black tuni on top to scare the crows. So you know, all these it's still simple, but you know, it's not even my mom doesn't make vattal these days, because now we don't live in a house anymore. There's no motamadi, we moved to an apartment. So yeah, many things like that are definitely lost recipes, right? Like you can easily buy vattal now from the store, and nobody makes it at home anymore. So
which is fine, I guess. But
I have vattal at home. I fry vattal every week. But you know, I'm not saying that it is a thing. Anytime there is a shortcut, I'll always take it. But it's just, you know, nobody knows how to do it anymore. I don't know how to do it myself, and maybe I should definitely learn it from my mom soon enough. But
yeah, I mean, I'm okay with us, you know, like finding these things. But a lot of these preservation techniques are also kind of lost. Like as you are mentioning these, like there's almost this almost entire subculture of sun drying just about everything, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, right from fish to vegetables, or even like some cuts of meat as well. And that bearing a few is kind of gone today. Like some of the vattals, like the Marathakali or the Sundakali, like we spoke about, are still available. Mm-hmm. But that's only a small fraction of the amount of, you know, sun-dried stuff that
was available to us. Yeah,
exactly. Like there's so many others that people don't do right now.
Kottavaranga vattal, or you know, even I remember, like even okra used to be soaked in like buttermilk and sun-dried. So vendaka vattal. There's so many vattals that my party even used to make. Now we don't. Like as simple as mor molaga, right? What an amazing concept. You soak green chilies in buttermilk, sour buttermilk, to cut the spice, and then you sun dry it. It's such an amazing thing to do. And, you know, something like that also, like, it's truly, I mean, of course, yeah, we get the vattal now. It's easy to just go and get it. But the whole reason behind why this was done is lost now. Like, the whole concept of why we preserve things. Like, I don't know if you watch the Chef's Table with this guy, Magnus, what's his name, the chef? And he's talking about, he lives in this Norway, Sweden things. And his restaurant is wholly about like preserving fish, preserving veggies, because 6 months of the year, literally they are buried under snow and there is nothing available to them. So they have to preserve everything during the summer if they want to eat in the winter, kind of thing. So, and he also says like not everybody now does it because everything is available in the supermarkets, but he runs his restaurant based on that. Like he does still everything like how it was done, like in the old world. So like it goes across cultures, right? This preserving, like if you want to eat, then you better make you know, preserve these things, kind of thing. That's not there anymore with all this modernization.
Yeah, so, now you have refrigerators, right? So
refrigerators, and like, you know, like if you want mangoes, it's not just like here, it's not just available in the summer. Like if you want local mangoes, yes, but in the supermarket, mangoes are always available. Sometimes they come in from Mexico, sometimes they come in from Peru, from Guatemala. So they're always there. So it's not like you are missing anything. You don't have to dry the mangoes, raw mangoes, when they're available, and have a manga vattal. So like when they are not available in winter, you can take like a handful of manga vattal and make a quick pickle. You know, you don't have to do that anymore because it's always available. So yeah, that I think the main reason of all these preserving and the recipes associated with these preservation techniques are slowly disappearing because we don't need to do it anymore, you know.
Yeah, like that, when you mentioned mango, it just kicked one whole memory in my head. Like one of the things my grandmom used to do was slice up the mangoes and then in a melt jaggery along with some red chili powder and salt, and then dip these mangoes in that.
Oh my God.
And then sun dry them.
Oh my God.
So they would sun dry, they would crinkle, but then they would have these dried pieces, as the jaggery, the kind of thing dries up along with it, it will have this entire taste. So it's like a flavor bomb, because there is salt, there is a sweet element, and also there is heat coming from the red chili powder, and the mango by itself is acid, right? So it is like one mind-blowing flavor bomb.
I can imagine. Wow, my mouth is literally watering just here, because I love mangoes. And that is one thing I've rediscovered after moving to the Caribbean, because here we get mangoes in summer. That's amazing. Like literally when you're driving down the street, like in January, you can see the mango trees starting to flower, right? So since then, like I'm like anticipating when will the mangoes come out, kind of anticipation is there. So yeah, I'm going to definitely try that recipe now that you mentioned it. It sounds almost like a fruit leather kind of, I think, I like
exactly.
In my, yeah, like that kind of idu is what I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, it's that whole jerky kind of thing going for it. But then it's because it has all these four tastes in it, it is something very, very unique. Now,
I've never had it. So
when you sun-dry, let's say, you know, the mor mulaga or okra or any of these things, when you sun or bitter melon, when you sun-dry them, they're different. It is sun-dried because from a preservation standpoint.
Correct.
Is sun-dried because this is a thing by itself, right?
Correct.
You kind of put them in these jardies or jars, and then whenever kids are running around crazy, just hand one to them, and you know,
that's amazing.
Onto it, and but these are things that are lost, right? And those things are, you know, hard to find or hard to replicate. Is where we're at. But again, you know, that's
life, right? But you know, is somehow as long as these recipes are preserved, I think, like how all these millets are coming back to fashion now, hopefully these recipes will also come back and have like a whole coming back to fashion thing soon, is my hope.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's all we can do, I guess, and hope that some of these grains, these millets, and some of these vegetables are brought back, because not only because they are suited to the climate and the geography, so you don't have to kind of worry about importing them from somewhere else. They grow readily in the Indian subcontinent. Also, B, because they have a lot of medicinal properties attached to them. So while being easily available, easy to grow, and they also have medicinal properties. So that hopefully these come back along with some of these millets and grains that we spoke about. But Anu, this was a fabulous conversation, and like some of the things that you just said, I was kind of cursing myself for also doing this episode, because now I'm not going to be able to, you know, stop thinking about them.
Like I have a bag of green mangoes that I bought at the farmers market today in my fridge. I'm definitely going to, like, here they slice the green mangoes up and they sell it in Ziploc bags, and they have this spicy hot pepper sauce that they pour on it if you want to. Like it's like super spicy for me, because it's like the hot, like almost scotch bonnet level heat pepper sauce, and I can't take that much heat. So I just buy the green mangoes by the bag and keep it in the fridge. I use it for like mango dal or anything that I want to make. And I'm definitely going to try the jaggery drying thing that you talked about, because like literally my mouth was watering when you were talking about it. Yeah, I learned a lot today.
it's always a pleasure having you, and it's fun. So, and I'm sure we'll do more of these. So thanks a lot, Anu. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
And then for everyone listening, you can find Anu on Instagram. Do check her out on Instagram. She is Anu Srini. She will kind of say, yeah, that she has three kids and a working mom and all of that, but her Instagram is a treasure trove of recipes and visually just fantastic. So do check her out on Instagram.
Thank you so much.
And this is Nerd Kitchen. We'll be back with more episodes soon. Keep listening on Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your fix from. Let your friends know and spread the word. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you. Bye.
On a winter, jump the other way.